Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us on History FM Radio on liveparanormal.com and history.fm. From paranormal to the unexplained history, it all happens here. Looking to enhance your radio experience? Participate in live interactive chat 24/7 with our radio show hosts and other like-minded people on www.liveparanormal.com, the only interactive social chat room supported by full interactive media. Stop by now and join in on the fun.
Live on history.fm and liveparanormal.com radio. This is Exploring Mysteries, Histories, and the Paranormal with Dr. John. This is John DeSalvo, your guide to the next 60 minutes, and I want to thank you for being with us tonight. Can one really summon angels and demons with ceremonial magic? What is Enochian magic? Is it dangerous to do this, or can the average person do this using protections? Is the world of angels and demons real or just part of our subconscious? We'll be exploring these questions and many more with my very special guest, Lon Milo Duquette. You know, it's such an honor and a pleasure to introduce my very good friend and mentor, Lon Milo Duquette, to the program. Lon is a famous ceremonial magician and actually is the author of so many books, I can't keep track of them. Every time I talk to Lon, he has another book coming out. I think he's pushing close to 20 books now. Lon's book, Enochian Vision Magic, was the inspiration for my last two books on Enochian magic. Lon, besides being a prolific author, gives talks and workshops all over the world and is an accomplished musician. And in fact, we'll be playing excerpts of his songs at the break and a full-length song at the end of the program. Lon also is an expert tarot reader and has specially designed a tarot deck, which is one of my favorites. When it was out of print, it was like selling for $175, but fortunately it's back in print and it's affordable for everyone. It combines magic, astrology, Kabbalah, and just about everything into one deck of cards. Really an amazing, powerful divination tool. Lon has a wonderful sense of humor, which actually comes through his books, especially his autobiography, My Life with the Spirits, which is such an incredible read. Well, I guess I'd like to welcome my very good friend, Lon Milo Duquette, to the program. Hello, Lon, and thanks for joining us tonight.
Well, thank you for having me on, and thank you for all those kind words.
Well, anyway, you know how much I appreciate all you've done for me and other practicing magicians. You've dedicated your life to this field, and many people are appreciative of all your help.
Well, I'm glad to be here. I'm just glad to be anywhere, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, I know the feeling. But I know I've told you this before, but I'd like to mention this for the audience, that after 30 years of me trying almost every known psychic and occult technique, you know, every how-to-do book, Lon, I bought it. Nothing ever seemed to work. And then I bought your book on Enochian magic, and right away it worked. It was the first thing that worked. It just blew open the psychic veil. I was in an altered state of consciousness, communicating with angels and angelic realms. Again, I'm so grateful to your book and then your personal guidance, and I just want to mention that I know many listeners probably are like me. They've tried everything, and I strongly recommend your book, Enochian Vision Magic. It has changed my life.
Wow. Well, you were probably ready for something to happen anyway, but I'm glad my book was a catalyst for you.
Well, I remember you told me Enochian Magic works even for someone with no magic ability, and I guess I'm standing proof of that.
But, yeah, me too. Jeez.
Well, you know, maybe we should start at the beginning. Maybe can you kind of define or give us a general kind of definition of magic? And, you know, we're not talking about the sleight of hand magic, but the ceremonial and ritual magic.
Right. Well, as generic as you can get, the definition for what magic is just anything that you do that causes change in your life in conformity with your will and your intent. So it can be just very, very mundane. Any willed action is technically a magical act. You've caused change to occur in conformity with your will. And what makes what brings it into sort of what other people might call supernatural and what saying spooky is that a ceremonial magician sets to work in a ritual manner, a ceremonial manner, to start affecting changes, but the chain reaction of events that the magician sets into motion sort of go into the invisible realm, and you can't really see all of the connections between the cause and the effect. Does that make sense?
Yes.
It's easier to explain what magic is nowadays when we can talk about the mechanics, quantum mechanics, and this idea that there are realms, that are levels of consciousness that seem to defy the Newtonian laws of physics that we're used to. Maybe the best example is this concept that you actually change the conditions of an experiment by observing what goes on, and just the mere fact that the experiment is being observed by a consciousness literally affects how the experiment comes out. We don't know exactly why that is, but it's a quantum mechanics fact. In a way, magic must also be working on that quantum level. It's not supernatural. I don't see it as supernatural. Even the concept of us working with demons and angels and spirit intelligences and all of the personages of these natural forces, I still even see that as being perfectly natural events. It's just that we don't understand them yet, so it seems supernatural.
You know, I really like that, Lon, because I have said 100 or 1,000 times that exactly what you said. When we look at something supernatural, there's probably a higher scientific law we just haven't discovered that explains it. And that's exactly what you're saying. I also, you know, one of my research interests was quantum mechanics and superstring theory. And if I ever write another book, that's the theme I would probably look at, how some of these areas of physics could explain these areas of magic. And the other thing you said I thought was really good, magic includes the will and intent. So it's not like certain spiritual exercises, you just throw open the barn door for everything or you're unconscious. You control. It's your intent and your will. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. And that's the key to it. And, if my nose is plugged up and I would like to clear my nose, it's a magical act to blow my nose, okay, because I want that done. In the morning, you know, I want to take a shower and brush my teeth, okay, because I want to face the day you know, really, really clean and feeling good about myself. Brushing my teeth is a magical act. And where we get into trouble in life is when our life is filled with unmagical acts, things that we would just react to. You know, I mean, reaching for your pocket, you know, for a third cigarette in the morning might not be a magical act. You know, unless it's really your intent. If you sort of mindlessly reach for that cigarette, I'm sorry, you're not doing a magical act. If you take the same route to work every day, thoughtlessly, just go on automatic pilot. Well, sure, it's probably your will to go to work, but is it really? In other words, magic is forcing us to wake ourselves up, and for most of our days, we're all asleep. We go through most of our life asleep, and magic is just one way, and it's sort of the Western traditional way of waking ourselves up. It has its parallel in Eastern mysticism, but we go about it in a little different way in the West, because we like to deal with things outside of ourselves in the West, you know, and in the East they like to deal with things inside of themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. So I sort of look at magic as sort of like Western Zen and ceremonial magic, where we use magical tools. And we deal with spirits and intelligences, angels and demons and such. What really we're dealing with are natural powers of natural forces in nature. We may not understand how they work, but we're dealing with them. And for the sake of the magical ceremony, we're actually personifying them. We're giving them names. We're giving them images. We're treating them as conscious units of creation, which is exactly what they are. And another big thing that quantum physics is telling us is that when you get behind almost everything, everything is of the nature of consciousness. And
you know,
it all becomes a consciousness thing, and that's what ceremonial magicians have been doing for aeons.
Yeah, I like what you said too. It kind of wakes us up because we're asleep. It reminds me when I was following Gurdjieff's teachings, very similar. You know, the whole point of his teaching and exercises was to be consciously aware of what you do. I never realized that magic does that. You know, it's interesting too when you said that. I know many times when I explore the higher realms, sometimes I'm not sure which is more real. You know, the as above, so below. It appears
right.
we're a shadow of the higher realm. So when you're into these realms, it seems like this is more reality. So almost like the movie Inception with the dreams, you know, dream within
yes.
a dream. Which is actually real?
Yes, and you know, that film was a marvelous example of at least dealing with consciousness. You know, as dream reality, vision reality, as you know, a bona fide part of the big tapestry of consciousness. It was a marvelous film. I was totally blown away. I followed it.
Yeah, and I saw it several times. It was just amazing. You know, you led us to a good point, a question I wanted to ask you, because I know there's a lot of controversy about it. Is magic really, when you go into the higher realms, is this really an independent reality, an objective world that exists independent of ours, which I actually believe it is based on my experience, or is it just our subconscious? And I know some magicians really say it doesn't really matter, but I was curious what you felt, you know, about that.
Well, it's you're not giving us all the alternatives. It is more than your subconscious for sure. But I do believe that along with the Kabbalists, that human consciousness is a very unique and important monad of consciousness, and that in its own way it is capable. Human consciousness is capable of being at least a miniature reflection, a harmonic of the great consciousness being, if that's what you want to call it. We are, you know, when you watch a wagon wheel, you know, moving along, you see movies and cowboy movies, you know, they show wagon wheels when in the spokes. Mm-hmm. And the spokes go real fast and they sort of disappear. And then all of a sudden, when the wagon hits at just a perfect speed, you see a harmonic, you see the spokes appear again, and they sort of appear to be moving backwards like that. Well, when the wagon hit the right frequency of turns in the wagon wheel, the spokes hit this frequency that it becomes visible again. Now, I'm not saying that I'm containing all of the black holes and all of the stars and galaxies in the universe in my subconscious, but what I'm saying is that I have the consciousness equipment to at least reflect an accurate harmonic of that great absolute consciousness. And I think that's exactly what the Kabbalists were trying to say when they said that humans are made in the image of deity.
Hmm.
Okay, I don't think that means that, you know, deity necessarily has five fingers and, you know, five toes and dandruff, you know.
But, otherwise, he would look like me, right?
Yeah, you look like, yeah. So. But what I think they were trying to say is that for some reason, maybe it's just a freak of evolution, but for some reason we have the consciousness equipment to be an accurate reflection of that great absolute, and that's what I mean when I say that. All of this is in our head. We just have no idea how big our head is, and that's what the Kabbalists were trying to tell us when they examined the human consciousness matrix and broke it up into three or four main sections, and one of those sections is the intellect. And that's our reasoning process and all of that. But the part of the soul, if you want to call it that, that's just a bit higher than the intellect, is this thing called the neshama. And the neshama, which they translate as soul intuition, that's that part of consciousness where we strive after that level of consciousness if we're really into psychic phenomena. When a mother wakes up in the middle of the night and her child has been in an accident, okay, it happens. It's not even considered, you know, spooky psychic phenomena. It happens. Mother wakes up, child's been in an accident across town. She wakes up at the exact moment when the child's in danger. Now that's an aspect of neshama. The child didn't send out a message, you know, a telegram across, you know, "Mom, I'm in trouble." If the child would have been on the other side of the earth, Mom would have got that message at the same time. If the child would have been on the moon, or the child would have been on Alpha Centauri, you know, what, six light years away, she would have still got the message instantly. That's because there's nowhere in the entire universe that that child can go that can escape the mother's neshama. Okay, and that means that neshama, this integral part of the human condition, has no restrictions in time or space, and that opens up the possibilities for all sorts of other wonderful things. This is why, for all intent and purposes, there is no outside of ourselves, because there is no limit to our neshama. This is why spirits can appear in triangles for magicians, and devotees can manifest tangible images of their deity or their saints or their gods, because in a sense there is no outside of ourselves when we look at things in terms of this Kabbalistic neshama. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it really does. And, you said something real interesting about, our brain, our capacity, how much we use. Again, I used to teach neurophysiology, and I always used to say, well, we don't know what percent of the brain that we use, but it may only be about 10%. And I always believed the other 90% or whatever was used for our psychic ability and even magic. And as I proposed in one of my books, the one which I was so grateful to you for writing a foreword to it, that I would love a ritual magician like yourself to go into the different realms and have brain activity monitored, and maybe we can actually identify what area or part of the brain is involved in this type of magic, and that would help us really understand and get a better scientific picture. But what I was going to ask you is that I know you're really the world's expert and the best on Enochian magic, and my last two books were on Enochian magic, and so I mean, to try to explain that in a few minutes is really an impossible question, but I have to ask you, maybe for listeners, you can give us an idea of what is Enochian magic and why is it so powerful?
We have to introduce everybody to Dr. John Dee, because that's the guy who more or less was facilitated the Enochian magic. John Dee was he was court mathematician and all-around counselor to Queen Elizabeth I. So we're talking the 1570s, 80s, 90s. He was an Elizabethan. He was a Renaissance magus. He was a brilliant, brilliant guy, probably certainly the smartest guy that would have had a good job in England, and he was an inventor, and he was a mathematician, and a theologian, and a chemist, and a doctor, he invented the maps and the charts that helped Elizabeth make England, lord of the waves, But because he was such a brilliant guy and could travel all over Europe, and he was like a rock star, a mathematical rock star, because he could he was so famous and could get access to all the courts of Europe, he made the perfect candidate to be a spy. And Elizabeth recruited him as a spy and sent him abroad. And he was literally England's first secret agent, and his code letters that he signed his secret dispatches to Elizabeth was 007.
Mm.
And this was, he really was 007, the first one. And but he got tired of actually getting on a boat and then clip-clopping his way all over Europe. He wanted to spy for Elizabeth in the comfort of his own home in Mortlake, England. And so taking the Bible as sort of as his guide, he figured that God communicated to the Old Testament patriarchs, including Enoch. And so if God could talk directly to Enoch, and if these biblical characters could commune with the communicating angels of God directly, then so could he. And so he set to work in his mind, scientifically make contact, direct contact with the mind of God and the hierarchical intelligences of angels. And he set to work to do it. And he took incredibly good notes, as you know.
That's true.
and he was really good at the scientific end of magically contacting these beings, but he was pretty bad at actually being kind of psychic enough to relax. He couldn't relax his great intellect enough to be a good receiver. His left hemisphere of his brain was so engaged that his right hemisphere couldn't relax enough to see visions and hear things. So he put an ad out for a right hemisphere, and he finally got a guy named Edward Kelly, and who as you know, he was somewhat of a scoundrel, but these guys really clicked, and in no time at all, they were making contact with spiritual intelligences that identified themselves as the same angels that spoke to the Old Testament patriarchs, and they systematically set to work to at first to spy for Elizabeth. And it was almost a case of where Dee would ask the angels, well, can you tell me if my friend, you know, Prince Laski is ever going to become king of Poland? And in so many words and in so many communications, angels more or less said, you know, well, we could tell you that for sure, you know, but first you're going to have to understand what we understand is Poland. And that what we understand is the Earth and the sphere of Earth, and what we understand is the solar system, and what we understand is the universe. In other words, you're going to have to think like an angel. You're going to have to experience. You're going to have to be attuned in the same way we're attuned. Otherwise, what we say won't make sense to you. And they set to work in three periods of time over about a little over two and a half years, of almost daily angelic communication. They sort of got the key to darn near everything. And they were given a language, the angelic language, and a key how to use that language to open up 91 parts of the earth, which in turn, that portion of the sphere of the earth was connected to 30 heavens or aethers, connecting absolutely everything in the cosmos to absolutely everything else. It's breathtaking, as you know. It's breathtaking. It's elegant. But after almost 3 years of working together, Dee and Kelly got on each other's nerves. And so they,
sounds like my Italian family at Thanksgiving time.
Yeah, you love them, but but yeah. Well, they got on each other's nerves, and so they received this incredible magical system, and then more or less broke up before they ever had a chance to actually use it. And a few hundred years later, it was up to the adepts of the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, back in around 1888, to find this last bit of material in the British library and turn it into a viable, workable system that was also compatible with their hermetic magic system that those anal retentive Englishmen were so devoted to.
You know, I want to mention too, you really took that information that was out there, that the Golden Dawn and Aleister Crowley and the OTO put in their rituals, and you simplified it for the average person. That was a great gift. I look at you as going down in history as setting a new example of how to use magic and how you brought it to the average person.
Well, that's very kind of you to say, but you got to remember, I just had to make it understandable to me. So that was my first goal, you know.
But you know, the key of it seems the Enochian calls. And I've always said the Enochian call, which opens up this realm or puts you in an altered state, to me, maybe because I look at it from a neurophysiological point of view,
yes,
it's like a mantra. We don't know how it works, of course, whether it works
right
on the brain. But, you know, do you have any guesses how you think the Enochian calls work? Which are, maybe you could explain what an Enochian call is and then maybe how you think it works.
Well, first of all, as you know, the Enochian calls in the so-called angelic language is a real language, and they receive the language in a painstaking way, letter by letter, you know, sometimes backwards, and when it was finally finished, and the angels provided the translation, they discovered that it really is a real language with consistent nouns and verbs and real grammar, real syntax, can be translated as easily as, well, maybe not as easily, but it can be translated like, you know, a Romance language like French or Italian. And there's a series of calls, and each of the calls opens up a specific area of the heavens, supposedly, which are connected to specific areas of on Earth too. So in my mind, when they say they open up specific sections of the heavens, I'm thinking, because of this Neshama thing, I'm thinking that means they're opening up very specific levels of my own consciousness, and if we want to look at it as the hardware of the brain, we're going into one of those sections of the brain that you mentioned that they don't know what they do, and unlocks that specific section, just that one section, no other sections, just that one. And there's 30 of these calls. And, there's actually 49 of these calls, but 30 of them are called the aethers or the heavens. And the key is just the changing of just one word in this almost beautiful, poetic, spooky sounding, it sounds very biblical, doesn't it? It sounds like Isaiah or a prophetic thing. It's almost like I sort of look at these calls when you translate them into English. They're almost like the school songs. If angels in different levels of heavens and consciousness, If they had school songs, these Enochian calls would be like their school song. And when they hear somebody singing their school song, it gets their attention. And when it gets their attention, they, in a sense, figuratively speaking, come into your living room to hear how you're singing their school song, and in doing so, they raise the consciousness frequency vibration in the room while they're there with you. And in that altered state of consciousness that they bring with them, you have your visions. Am I saying that okay?
Yeah, and you know, I have to say something for people listening. It works. It really works. And, you know, I was going to ask you about that. You know, I've done probably the Enochian magic, which I call it Enochian meditation because I kind of turned it into a meditation probably hundreds of times. And it's just about works every single time. And I have never experienced anything negative. And I was going to ask you, in your 20 or 30 years, I'm sure you've probably done this thousands of times, have you ever experienced anything negative in the Enochian call area of magic?
No.
It's amazing, isn't it?
No, I haven't. You know, I can't say that about crossing the street. You know, I can't say that about breakfast. No, it is, in my experience, it is the cleanest, most breathtakingly powerful thing that I've ever encountered. And it's not to say that there might be some people that do it and have an unpleasant experience. And I hear tales of, oh, people dabbled with Enochian magic and they found that, they went back into their bedroom and they found things, moved around. But even all of that kind of stuff, they lived through it, you know. It's a big deal, you know. In my experience and the experience of people that I've done this with, and I've done classes, and I've done group workings and group scryings, I've worked with this for 30 years or more.
And did you have a group every week? A group of people do it for 20 years? You have feedback from hundreds of people over long periods of time. So it's not just you. It's a really good statistical summary. You know, amazing.
Yeah, and so but we always have to remember if a person has mental issues to begin with, that doing any kind of magic usually is not helpful. You know, if you're and I don't want to sound flippant about it, but if you're crazy to begin with, you're magic's not going to help you. You're still going to be crazy, and then the only thing then is that you'll have magic to blame it on.
I agree. You know, and I always say too, it may not be for everyone. You have to use your judgment. Right. And really, it's uncharted territory. You know, we don't have all the answers. We're learning just like everyone else. And I think that's interesting. One thing I do want to make clear is that this type of magic that we're talking about, the Enochian magic, the magic that you wrote in your wonderful book, Enochian Vision Magic, is not the time that's conjuring up demons and binding them and having them do things for us. It's a way of opening up our consciousness to higher realms to communicate with good angels. So it's a little bit different than what people usually envision magic as. Do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely, and that's why it's your preference of calling it Enochian meditation is really really accurate, because it is magic, but because it deals with one's own subjective abilities to see visions. And to be conscious of consciously aware of what's going on in your mind, it's a classic description of a meditation. So,
that's good to hear. And there's nothing wrong too if people want to do some type of protection and prayers, and if it makes them feel good. And I usually do that. I always recommend that. I was going to ask you, too, the lesser banishing ritual of the pentagram, to me, I find is the most efficient type of protection in any kind of magical act, and even just to go to bed at night to quiet down the environment and block things off. And I was wondering what you felt about that.
Oh, yeah. Well, for Well, if you would have asked me this, 10 years ago, I would have said yes, and I never blow my nose magically without doing a banishing ritual of the pentagram. but the magician evolves too, and what happens for one season of your magical life, you absolutely kind of need to ground yourself with certain rituals and certain ideas. But if you do them right, and if you do them long enough, there comes a time when you do them automatically.
Yes.
When you do it, when you magic as you evolve requires you to do more and more with less and less. And so for instance, Dee and Kelly didn't do any banishing rituals or anything else, but they prayed for about 2 hours before. I mean, they were praying fools. They just prayed the daylights out, and they prayed themselves into altered states of consciousness. It was the equivalent of a wonderful banishing ritual of the pentagram and hexagram and everything else. They got themselves there in their own way. I've come to the place anyway in my Enochian workings where I know what it takes to enter into this environment safely. And for many, 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 many years, that meant a banishing ritual of the pentagram, prior to working. Now I do a little something else, but that's just me now.
You drink a bottle of scotch or no? I'm just...
I don't... Since I've gone on my diet,
I agree with you, Lon. And, it's really interesting you said that, because I think, especially with this type of magic, it is so controlled. It is so, like you said at the beginning of the show, the intent and the will, that essentially we probably don't need these, but it's mainly probably just for us, for our own satisfaction. And if that gives a person more confidence, it's great, by doing a banishing ritual or saying a prayer. And the other example I always like to give is that, people always just ask me about the Ouija board, and I always say it's dangerous because you're opening up the barn door and letting anything in. With Enochian magic, it is controlled. We know where we're going and who we're letting in.
Yeah, I like your analogy there, because Ouija type workings really does open a huge barn door. And Enochian type working just opens up a small little slit in a Venetian blind, okay, and it's and you know what you're going for, you know where you're going, and you deal with it that way. I've never, with the exception of misspelling certain angel names in Enochian, which ended up in an almost comical vision, I've never inadvertently opened up any kind of a negative force using Enochian. It's almost as if, gee, these calls contain within themselves such incredible resonance and such incredible purity that nothing even has a chance to perform any mischief.
Oh, I like that, because I notice when I do it, almost when people ask, can you explain it? I say it's almost like being on holy ground. It really is. So
it really is.
I have to ask you this, because we've been friends for many years, and I was going to ask you what your family thinks of what you do. And the reason I ask you this is my daughter came home one day from school and said, Dad, I never realized all the strange areas of research you were in until I tried to explain to my friends what you do.
Oh, well, yes, we have one son. He's with us. He's with us today with our grandson. As a matter of fact, I hear him out there playing with his trucks. You know, it's been such a normal part of our family and a normal part of growing up, and we were so conscious to bring him up in a very, very normal, unspooky kind of way, but most importantly, the Duquette family has a very, very wonderful sense of humor, and we make each other laugh a lot, and the whole idea that our neighbors might find what we do very very weird is more funny to us than it is of a concern. And Jean-Paul always had a nice circle of friends that thought we were pretty interesting, pretty funny, pretty good parents. And those boys are now they're now 40 years old. They're still friends. I still see them on the street. They still call me Papa. They still yell Papa. And as a matter of fact, my new book that I'm working on is called Family Magic, and it's sort of an anecdotal, autobiographical book concerning my family life, what it's like to have this sort of a spiritual life and still be a relatively normal person going to PTA meetings and all of that.
You know, I was going to mention too, Lon, I have your books linked up to Amazon.com and information about you on our radio website, drjohnradio.com. That's drjohnradio.com. And listeners could download previous shows for free and listen to them and see our upcoming guests. And, we're getting towards the end of the program, and there was so much I wanted to talk to you about. You know, one of your areas is a U.S. Deputy Grand Master of the OTO, the Aleister Crowley Group, and I'd like to have you come back, if you don't mind, and do another show, maybe just on Crowley and the OTO, if that's something you'd be interested in.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'd love to do that.
Now, what do you have coming up? Oh, before I mention, too, at the end, after we do the acknowledgments and the end show bumper music, I want to leave time to play one of your songs. I got so wrapped up talking to you, I forgot the half-hour commercial. So,
good Lord.
But what I'd like to do is play that the one song which you composed and played, and it runs for, I think, about 4 minutes. So after the my ending acknowledgments and bumper music, don't turn the radio off. We're going to have, I'll play the whole track of Lon's song. It's really wonderful. So, and thanks for sending that. I think that's, the listeners are going to enjoy that. But what do you have coming up? Any workshops or travel or appearances you'd like to mention?
Yeah, it's been a really busy year for me. And I'm going to be believe it or not, at the end of the month, in the beginning of September, I'm going to be in Omaha, which I haven't been back to Nebraska in 45 years. So I'm doing a couple talks in Omaha, and then I'm going to be doing the Harvest Gathering in Connecticut, in Danbury, Connecticut, I believe on the weekend of the 11th of September. And then I'm going to Salem, Massachusetts, and doing a series of talks in Salem. And if anyone is on Facebook, please be a Facebook fan, because that's where I really, really keep everybody, apprised of my my goings on.
And, yeah, what do you have, like about 10,000 fans on Facebook now? And you're one of the most popular people out there. It's really amazing the following you have, Lon.
Well, I'm a shameless self-promoter. I tell people they don't have to read my books, but I sure appreciate it if they buy them.
So. Oh, that's so funny. But, Rolando, again, a thousand things I'd love to talk to you about. And I guess I really want to thank you so much for being on tonight. You're just a wonderful guest, and you promised to come back, and I really appreciate that, Lon.
Okay.
Well, listen, again, I want to thank my special guest, Lon Milo Duquette, for being with us tonight. I'd like to thank Rob Zierick, owner of LiveParanormal.com Radio, for hosting this program, and Carla at Master Control, ClassicalIndia.com, for permission to use their music, and most especially you, the listeners, for joining us tonight. And I hope you join us again next week for another special guest. You can check out our listing of our upcoming programs and guests at www.drjohnradio.com. And you can listen to our past programs for free in our radio archives. So until next week, good night, and may God be with you. And please stay tuned for a song from Lon Milo Duquette.
I strike the bell, O Prince of Hell, I thank you for appearing. I paid the price, denied the Christ, eschewed Jehovah's fearing. God. for just